Good day, and welcome to the ProAssurance Workers' Compensation Briefing. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Frank O'Neill. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Caitlin. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this ProAssurance Workers' Compensation Briefing. Our news releases and SEC filings provide important information about the significant risks and other factors that could affect our business and alter expected results. We urge you to read and understand those. Also know that we may make statements on this call today dealing with projections, estimates, and expectations. These are explicitly identified as forward-looking statements subject to safe harbor protections reserved for those statements. The content of this call is accurate only on September 5, 2014. Except as required by law or regulation, we will not undertake and expressly disclaim any obligation to update or alter information disclosed as part of those forward-looking statements. We may reference non-GAAP items on our call today, and we refer you to our SEC filings for the required reconciliation. Participating with me on the call today are five members of Eastern's senior management team: President Mike Boguski, Executive Vice President Kevin Shook, Robert Gilpin, Senior Vice President for Field Operations and Marketing, Suzanne Emmett, Senior Vice President for Claims, and Cynthia Sklar, Senior Vice President for Underwriting and Risk Management. As they each make their presentations, we're going to pause right after that for a brief question and answer period about that portion of Eastern's operations, and then we'll have a longer form Q&A period at the conclusion of prepared remarks. Those of you who may have joined by the webcast can submit questions to us through the webcast screen. One final note, we're going to be focusing only on ProAssurance's workers' compensation segment today. We're not going to be able to answer questions about any of our other segments. Ned Rand, ProAssurance's Chief Financial Officer and Executive Vice President, is also on with us today, and he's going to open the call with a brief overview of the items that made Eastern's transaction with ProAssurance so compelling for us. Ned?
Thanks, Frank, and good morning to everybody. You know, the rationale for the transaction with Eastern was really quite simple. Healthcare is changing in the United States and changing dramatically. And in order to serve the needs of our evolving clients, ProAssurance also has to evolve. Our transaction with Eastern combines two best-in-class insurance companies and brings them together to provide solutions for the largest liabilities that large integrated healthcare systems face. Highlighting just a few things that the combined organizations can do together. Starting with the segregated portfolio cells that Eastern writes in the workers' compensation space. As we see healthcare systems becoming larger and larger, you see more self-insurance in that space, and the ability to offer them a turnkey solution for both their medical professional liability and workers' compensation needs is very compelling. Eastern also brings product diversification and geographic diversification for ProAssurance. When you look at the results of workers' compensation and medical professional liability, they're somewhat uncorrelated, and we believe that the company in the long term will benefit from that diversification. Last and very important is the fact that Eastern was a bolt-on transaction. You'll hear from the senior management team at Eastern shortly, and the entire team came over with the transaction, which was very important to us. And ProAssurance's objective is to enable them to do their jobs and not interfere with them doing their jobs and continuing the success that they've done. So as a result of that, there's been very limited integration with Eastern. We've integrated back office type operations, but left them largely to their own devices to run in the markets they run. And with that, I'd be happy to turn things over to Mike.
Thank you, Ned, and welcome all. I wanted to start the briefing by providing a brief history and background, some background information on Eastern. And I'll start with page 9 of the presentation. I'm Mike Boguski, president. This is my 28th year in the property and casualty industry with previous positions at Aetna Property and Casualty and PMA Group for 9 years, starting in the industry in 1986. And I've been with Eastern for 17 years. I was very fortunate to be hired as the first employee in July of 1997 by the directors of Eastern Insurance Holdings and Cater's Mutual Life to start the workers' compensation operation. Moving to page 10 of the presentation, The Eastern startup was very much an entrepreneurial venture. Our initial vision was to start the company. We started the company above a tattoo parlor in downtown Lancaster with $4.2 million in capital, which was a joint venture between Eastern and Educators Mutual Life. That's $2.1 million each in capital contribution. Our initial vision was to be a specialty underwriter of workers' compensation with focus on the small business community, and obviously at $4.2 million in capital, that was the market we needed to serve. Our initial strategy included a rural underwriting strategy, the ability to deliver value-added professional risk management, claims, marketing, and underwriting services on a local basis to mid-sized to large regional agents in the state of Pennsylvania. We established very strong relationships in the early days and actually required our initial agents to invest in our holding company as part of a first line of underwriting, which was an interesting strategy at the time. We thought we would eventually expand in the workers' compensation alternative market segment, which was an initial theme. And as a result of the joint venture with Educators Mutual Life, we had considered the 24-hour coverage strategy in the start of the companies. First year, we wrote $3.2 million of direct written premium with 14 investor agents with a staff of 5 insurance professionals above the tattoo parlor. Interestingly, those initial agency relationships represent approximately $60 million of the company's writings today. Taking it to the 1998-1999 timeframe, we did expand into the alternative markets arena with the approval and conversion of Eastern Re Limited to be the first segregated portfolio cell company in Cayman. In addition to that, we secured our first alternative market program, the Pennsylvania Builders Association, and we're proud to report today that they've been a very loyal customer. We started with $750,000 in premium in 1999, and today they have an active book of premium with Eastern of $8 million. So it's been a very successful longer-term program. As you look at the alternative markets operation today, it represents 26.4% of Eastern's premium writings. From 2000 to 2006, we really continued the build-out of the Pennsylvania workers' compensation platform. Interestingly, from an ownership perspective, in 2001, the Eastern Board bought out the interest of Educators Mutual Life at slightly above the initial $2.1 million investment plus some interest. From a fundraising and capital raising perspective, from 2000 to 2006, we raised capital in 2002 via a $19.1 million equity offering and followed on in 2003 with an $8 million trust preferred offering. And this was largely to support the growth of a high-quality book of business in Pennsylvania. By year-end 2005, the company had expanded its writings in Pennsylvania to approximately $78 million. In 2006, we had a game-changing transaction. We completed a $75 million stock offering and entered the public market via merger conversion with our previous partner, Educators Mutual Life. We entered the public markets with on the NASDAQ with the symbol EIHI, with essentially a core workers' comp business, the segregated portfolio business I mentioned earlier, and an ancillary benefit business that came over from Educators Mutual Life, which we renamed and rebranded Eastern Life and Health. The strong capital position at the time presented the company with the opportunity to execute a very disciplined state strategy and diversification plan. And so if you take a step back from 97 to 2005, we were primarily Pennsylvania-only specialty workers' comp carrier. From 06 to the present, we've added offices, and I'll just go through these, in the Southeast, in Charlotte, North Carolina, Nashville, Tennessee, and Richmond, Virginia. In the mid-Atlantic, we added a Pittsburgh or Wexford office, and in the Gulf South, we've added Madison, Mississippi. These were all organic initiatives. From an acquisition perspective during that period, We acquired Employer Security Insurance Company in the Midwest in Indianapolis, Indiana in 2008, which we converted to our Midwest regional office and that is serving us today. From that perspective, and also from a capital management perspective, we had repurchased about $56 million worth of our stock during that period. As you look at the build-out today, the workers' comp segment of ProAssurance is positioned well with an active book of about over $200 million in direct written premium, 8 offices, writing business in 16 core states, represented by 205 high-quality agents and 240 insurance professionals that we have today at Eastern. I'm pleased to report, you know, during that period of time, from inception of the company to 12/31 of 2013, the company delivered a statutory combined ratio of 86.5% and $92.1 million of statutory net income, which obviously benefited shareholders during that period of time. So that's kind of our track record until the ProAssurance transaction. On page 12, just a minute to talk about corporate culture, which is always extremely important in a transaction. We believe that ProAssurance and Eastern are an excellent fit from a culture perspective, with integrity as the foundational core value that unites our organizations. ProAssurance and Eastern continue to operate the business with an employee of choice and best places to work mentality. Today, Eastern employs 240 employees with very low turnover and no turnover of a senior executive team since the inception of the operation in 1997. We're also extremely proud from a culture standpoint that both ProAssurance and Eastern were recently named to the Ward's Top 50 for insurance company performance. Before I introduce the Eastern senior executive team, I'd like to briefly comment on Eastern's 2014 strategic initiatives, which are outlined on page 14. When Stan and Ned and I talked about 2014, really two goals. One, as Ned stated earlier, we wanted to achieve Eastern's strategic operational and financial plan in 2014 and really continue to do what we've done well. And then the second strategy is really to execute a successful integration, which we are on plan to accomplish as we've been together for 8 months. I've asked our senior executive team today to comment on the 2014 strategic plan, which is focused on the following, our continued organic growth plans, very disciplined geographic expansion, healthcare market penetration and cross-selling with ProAssurance, management of profitability as we remain a bottom-line focused organization, and continued organizational excellence and successful integration with ProAssurance. So at this point in time, I'd like to introduce the Eastern executives. Joining us today for today's briefing is Suzanne Emmett, Senior Vice President of Claims, Bob Gilpin, Senior Vice President of Marketing and Field Operations, Cindy Sklar, Senior Vice President of Underwriting and Risk Management, and Kevin Shook, Executive Vice President. I was truly blessed to have the opportunity to recruit this team between 1997 and 2001, and they continue to drive our business plan forward and are the Eastern experts and leaders within their respective disciplines. I'd like to introduce Kevin Shook, Executive Vice President, to review our high-level financial results in the company's business model.
Thank you, Mike. First of all, my background, which is not very exciting, and I guess being a financial and actuarial type, that's probably a positive. Mm-hmm. I spent 9 years at Pricewaterhouse doing nothing but working in the insurance and reinsurance businesses and specializing in consulting, IPOs, and mergers and acquisitions. And on October 15, 2001, for some reason the date sticks in my mind. I can't always remember my anniversary, but I know when I started at Eastern. I joined Eastern and obviously have been here ever since. And in the public company days, you know, 8 months ago, I functioned as a chief financial officer, I still have significant financial oversight responsibilities in addition to operational responsibilities and internal actuarial responsibilities. So what I intend to do today, and we're going to start on page 16, is give you a high-level overview of some of the operational and financial highlights most recently, and then take you through, again, very high-level, the Eastern business model. And the Eastern business model slide and our thought process there really evolved over time. And, you know, the five of us would go into meetings with AM Best, and we'd walk in with a one-foot binder full of information and data and talking about why we're different and how our results are sustainable during changing economic cycles and changing insurance times. And one year, the analyst from AM Best called me and said, "Look, Kevin, this is great information," and he had all the white binders from all the years on his shelf. "You know, why don't you just tell us why Eastern's different, why your results have been sustainable during difficult economic times and insurance cycles?" And that's what we've kind of devised in terms of what we refer to as kind of our secret sauce. So just going to page 16, first of all, from a high level, our financial model has been very simple, and it's purposely simple. We are here to make an underwriting profit, and that is priority 1, 2, and 3. Another area of focus is managing expenses. We think in workers' compensation, which is highly competitive, managing expenses is a competitive advantage in the marketplace. And then thirdly, and equally as important, is capital allocations to the appropriate states. Like most insurance products, workers' compensation is regulated on a state-by-state basis, and there are laws that are different on a state-by-state basis, whether it's on the underwriting umbrella, claims, risk management, and you're going to see that we focus more on the rural areas, and we'll get into that a little bit. Our direct written premium was $52.5 million for the 3 months ended June 30th, 2014. About a 13.6% increase over the period in the prior year, and it was really driven by three factors. Strong new business production, audit premium of about $825,000, and renewal rate increases of about 2%. And you read a lot about renewal rate increases, and what I'm reading in some of the industry publications are really being driven by some of the states that had very, very poor results. And as I always tell people, your renewal rate increases are only as important as your starting point, which is your loss ratio. So we're very, very happy that we're getting 2% on our very, very profitable book of workers' compensation business. Our GAAP combined ratio as reported, so if you pick up our 10Q for the June quarter, was 93.7%. And that included about 3.7 points of purchase accounting, transaction-related expenses, and one-time charges. So the GAAP combined ratio that you see here is the 93.7% minus the 3.7%, which is a 90 that's in the second bullet point. As Mike mentioned, we've had a focus state expansion. Our strategy is, again, 100% bottom-line focused. Each territory that we go into tends to be have very, very high declination rates, which is a very good thing from our perspective. We tend to be extremely selective, particularly when we're entering into new areas. So we have the four regions that Mike mentioned, 16 core states, although we're licensed in 30, and a combination of 8 regional/satellite offices. And one of the themes that you're going to hear from our team today is that workers' compensation is a local business, and that is a very, very important part of the Eastern model. We believe it's extremely important for our employees to be familiar with the local business environment, the specific accounts that we may or may not write, the healthcare system, the lawyers, and certainly the agents. And the people that are from those communities that have worked in those areas are the best people to serve Eastern and to serve our customer base as well. We're going to discuss our select agency partnership strategy. Bob's going to get into that in great detail. From a very, very high level, our agent strategy is that Eastern's an exclusive arrangement. We refer to our agents as agency partners. And Mike talked about the fact that the in-force book of business is approximately $200 million. We only have 205 contracts to support that. It's our goal to be the first or second largest writer of workers' comp in each of those small to large size agencies, which we believe provides us with leverage in terms of developing those relationships and getting injured workers back to work. If you move to the next slide, this is the business model. This is the secret sauce that I refer to, and all of these are equally as important. A lot of people will look at Eastern and they'll say, well, you close claims so much more quickly than the industry, you must have a great claims department. And the answer to that is we do have a great claims department, and you'll hear about that from Suzanne, how our claim function works, what our strategies are. But the fact of the matter is there's more to closing claims than just having a great claims department. And the first bullet point talks about a disciplined state strategy assessment process. And I talked about allocating capital by states. Every year we go through a very detailed state strategy assessment process where we look at all of the states that we're in and we rate them for the underwriting environment, the claims environment, the market share potential, the economic and other demographics, and then calculate an overall assessment score and really say, here's the states we're in, do we want to continue to be in them, and here's the states we're thinking about expanding into, and are these states that we want to expand into. And I'll give you some examples. In 2013, we wrote $121.9 million in Pennsylvania and $91,000 in New York, and that was all in support of Pennsylvania risks where there were exposures in New York. We wrote $17.9 million in Indiana, and we wrote about $150,000 in Illinois, again, in support of Indiana. Local teams on the ground to support the business is extremely important as part of that state strategy assessment, as I mentioned earlier. We have a disciplined individual account underwriting strategy with a focus on rate adequacy in rural territories. You are not going to see us being very prevalent in large cities. I always joke around with people and say, if you're driving down the road and you see the billboard that says if you've been injured or think you may have been injured, call this number. Those are territories we tend to stay away from. We think the model works better outside of large cities where there's less attorney involvement and there's generally less union involvement as well. We offer a broad workers' compensation product spectrum, which is extremely important. When I look at what happened in 2008, 2009, 2010, and even thereafter, we didn't lose customers because we didn't offer a product within workers' compensation. And quite frankly, during changing insurance cycles, during changing economic times, and during our customers changing business needs as they're growing or shrinking, we're able to move them into different products that might be more beneficial to them or that might be more beneficial to the Eastern model as well. Cindy's going to talk about the fact that we have a broad underwriting diversification by class code. We write in over 600 different class codes. Suzanne's going to talk about extensive medical cost containment initiatives, which within the world in general is so important. And what you're going to see is that the medical portion of a workers' comp claim is becoming more significant now than it was in the past, and Suze is going to talk about that. Proactive claims management and strategic use of return to wellness. We believe and we know that we're providing a benefit to an injured worker by helping them get back to wellness and get back to their job. And Suzanne's going to talk about a number of the initiatives that we have in that area. And then one of my favorites is value-added risk management. With my financial and actuarial background, I like to measure everything I possibly can. And you can never measure the accidents that you don't have because you've got quality risk management people. We have about 28 people for our $200 million book of business and very, very value-added in terms of getting into new regions and really offering a service to our customers that is going to save them money long-term and really help them with their own employee safety. We talked about the strategic partnership and also the geographic diversification. And the next couple of slides are really support for the business model. So I'm going to move through these relatively quickly to give you more time to talk with Bob, Suzanne, and Cindy. But slide 18 shows the broad product spectrum. Mike mentioned the alternative markets being a little over a quarter of our book of business. And when you think about alternative markets and where it was 10 years ago and where it's going to be in 5 years, it is absolutely a piece of the commercial property and casualty sector that you cannot ignore. And we think we have the best model out there in the industry. The next slide just is an illustration of the risk diversification that I had previously mentioned, over 600 different class codes. And writing in diverse class codes was extremely important when we were going through the economic downturn in 2008, 2009, and 2010. There are some class codes that are obviously more immune, not fully, but more immune to the economic downturn than some of the other class codes. And we're able to tweak that as we go through those changing economic times and, quite frankly, changing insurance cycles. And as you look at those top 10 classes, I would point out two things. Number one, aside from clerical and office, we don't have a single class code that makes up more than 10% of our book of business. And the other thing, which is not ironic about Eastern and ProAssurance coming together, is that four of our top 10 class codes are healthcare-centric or healthcare-related, which was very attractive from Eastern's perspective and obviously very attractive from ProAssurance's perspective. One of my favorite slides is on page 20. These are our claim closing patterns. This is our traditional book of business. So this is everything that we are not ceding to our segregated portfolio cell company in the Cayman Islands. And if you just focus on that bottom row and you start from left to right, 1998, zero open claims, and just go all the way to 2007, this is net of reinsurance. We have 17 open claims in our entire company in our traditional book for accident years 2007 and prior, which is by far and away above and beyond what the industry does. And again, it's the great best-in-class claims, but it's all of the other measures that we employ that allow us to achieve this result. So we can look our investors in the eye, the rating agencies, our policyholders, our agents, and our employees and say, our results have been verified. Our claims are closed. And Mike talked about the 86.5% statutory combined ratio since inception. And you can see how those results are verified with these claim closing patterns. And from a reopen perspective, it's extremely rare that we would get a reopen claim once it's been closed for a period of about a year or more.
Hey, Kevin.
Sure.
On slide 19, the bottom says active policies. 7,000. How does that fit with the comment that you made, Mike, about the 200 accounts, you know, at the outset?
$200 million in premium.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a premium dollar. This is policy count.
Was that
205 agents.
205 agents for $200 million of active direct written premium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other questions before I move on?
Hey, Greg, just as a follow-up, if you add our alternative market book of business, our overall customer base at Eastern would be around 9,000 policyholders.
Oh, okay.
For the 200 million.
Page 21 is a simple illustration of our geographic footprint. We're licensed in 30 states, and Bob Gilpin will get into more detail on the regional office structure in a little bit. And then on page 22 shows a kind of a history comparison of our geographic expansion initiatives. 5 years ago in June of 2009, Pennsylvania represented 81% of our book of business, and today it represents about 55.9% of our book of business. And the geographic expansion has been very methodical, very logically thought out. The same claim closure patterns that we've experienced and the same Eastern overlay in our expanded geographic regions that we've experienced in the Mid-Atlantic and in particular in Pennsylvania has been employed in those regions. And we've been very successful with that. And again, those results have been verified as well. Moving on to page 23, I'm going to end with a couple slides on our alternative market product, which has been recently branded as Enova. And that is going to be the brand for the combined companies, for the medical professional liability, and for the workers' comp alternative markets. We think that offering monoline expertise for healthcare-centric organizations for professional liability, and then obviously on the workers' comp, is a very, very unique product. And we think something that is has been well-received and will be well-received by healthcare organizations. And if you really think about workers' comp and medical professional liability for healthcare organizations, they're typically two of their most difficult placements, and they're typically two of their more expensive placements. And the fact that they can go to the ProAssurance family of companies and get those two difficult lines taken care of with monoline expertise is very unique. And as I tell a lot of our healthcare customers, you know, with what is going on in the world and what is going on in healthcare reform, it is more important than ever that you manage your controllable expenses. And what better way to manage both workers' comp and medical professional liability than to put them into a segregated portfolio cell where generally the underwriting profits inure to the benefit of the policyholder and, in some cases, ProAssurance. So both lines go into a single segregated portfolio cell. We leverage the monoline expertise for both. Equally as important in our alternative market or our NOVA product is the non-healthcare piece, which is something that Eastern has had all along. Several of our segregated portfolio cells currently are healthcare related, but there's many that are not. We will continue to grow and focus on healthcare opportunities as they come up, and we will equally continue to grow and focus on non-healthcare opportunities as they come up. Innova is a high ROE product for ProAssurance. We receive fee-based revenue for the business that we write. We jointly own several of the segregated portfolio cells, so we do have direct underwriting profits on many, many of the programs, and it's very capital efficient as the customers provide a large amount of the capital through irrevocable, unconditional, evergreen letters of credit. And this is the one I always find very interesting. Innova enhances agency partnerships in really two ways. Number one, the agents have a better understanding as to what it's like to take risk. It educates them on the principles of claims, underwriting, and risk management. And then secondarily, it's a high retention product. When we get our customers into this type of product and they see the profit potential, and they see that this is a great long-term solution to controlling two of their more difficult placements, they don't shop the product every year. So from an agency perspective, it's a high retention product. And it's helped Eastern in our geographic expansion efforts because we have products that are kind of East Coast related, lumbermen's products, building contractors, ambulance programs, long-term care programs that we're able to use that might be domiciled in Pennsylvania, but we can then say in our geographic expansion area as well, we can write some of those accounts as we get into the Mississippi area, as we get into the Southeast, and that's how we're leading in some of these expanded areas.
Can you maybe talk about the capital that ProAssurance or Eastern puts into the segregated cells on average, I guess?
Well, into the segregated portfolio cells themselves, we put nothing into them. They're self-capitalized in two ways. Number one, by the premium that we write and we collect, and we see to the cells. And the second way that the actual SPC is capitalized is through those letters of credit, or we do trust arrangements as well. And every once in a while with the interest rate environment, we do have a customer that says, is it okay if I give you cash? Which we gladly accept. So there's a couple different ways we do it. The core of Eastern Re has capital, and that's the general portfolio of the core of Eastern Re, but that's there primarily to support a business that's in the core of Eastern Re. Okay. Page 24, just very quickly, this is the risk diversification pie chart for alternative markets or Innova. And I would just point out that in this part of our business, we write in over 400 different class codes. Some of these are higher hazard, and higher hazard in Eastern you have to take with a grain of salt. They're a higher hazard for Eastern. Alternative markets is a good way and an efficient way to write some tougher classes of business where Eastern's not taking the full underwriting risk. But I would also point out the prevalence of healthcare-related class codes also in our alternative market book of business. And then the last slide that I'm going to go through before I turn it over to Bob is the alternative market claim closing patterns.
I'm just trying to, you said high hazard or higher hazard. Can you give us an example?
Sure. We do two programs that are related to commercial contracting and residential contractors in the building industry. We have another program. We have one program for lumbermen. We have an ambulance EMT program, which off the cuff, you would say, well, how is that higher hazard? There's a lot of lower back injuries from lifting patients into ambulances. There's a lot of timber in Pennsylvania, and with a rural underwriting strategy, and a lot of our territories, there's a lot of trees. So we do have a lot of that.
That's a kind of it's kind of a wood products program. So you have diversification from sawmills, lumbermen, and different wood manufacturing type operations, and that's also a program that we sell outside of Pennsylvania, but it was started here.
It's one of the ones that I referenced that has helped us expand geographically because it's in a lot of our different regions right now.
And just for clarification on that, we do not own a piece of that cell because of the high head. So from Eastern's perspective, it's primarily a fee-based revenue opportunity.
Is this just where you're participating, your partnership with the insured and the insured's expanding, so you're just benefiting from their expansion? Or is this actually new customers that we're bringing onto the platform?
New customers that we're bringing onto the platform that, quite frankly, in that case, our customers benefiting from our geographic expansion initiatives because they're taking on profitable accounts that they normally wouldn't be able to get to without the Eastern agency model and regional office model.
Competitors aren't offering a competing product like that. You're telling me you're the only ones in the market doing that? Or?
Not necessarily the only ones, but we've got long-term track record of not getting in and out of comp. One of the benefits of being a monoline workers' comp writer for our customers, we don't jump in and out of comp. We do it all the time. So we have a reputation in the marketplace of providing great service and being a long-term player in workers' comp, and that's what a lot of our customers want, particularly in those types of industries.
Okay. In that example, Greg, you see a lot of volatility with, say, a logger. Be in the state fund 1 year, a stock carrier might write it the next year, and the alternative market solution brings it all together and provides some stability.
And then lastly, and I'm happy to take more questions, the last slide 25 is that same claim closing slide, but for our alternative market or our Enova book of business. And what I always find very interesting is we talked about slightly higher hazard book of business, but this really supports our thesis about having the policyholder having skin in the game, in certain cases agents, obviously the insurance companies. In slightly higher hazard groups of business, the claim closing patterns are even better in our alternative market book of business than it is in the lower hazard traditional book of business. And if you just quoting that same 2007 and prior open claim number, we have three in our alternative market book of business for those same years. So the model works. It's a great long-term financial solution for our customers, and it's very healthcare-centric in terms of what we have and what we see as opportunities in the future.
Let's pause right now just for a little bit, and I don't see any questions coming through from those who have joined us online. Caitlin, would you open up the line? Let's briefly see if we have any questions for Kevin from the people who have dialed in.
If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. And if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment.
While you're waiting for a question, can I just go back to the agent? You have the slide here, I think, on 22. Is that the total diversification of all premium?
That's premium diversification.
Diversification. So if I were to put the distribution channel overlay on that, would it be comparable? Would you have, two agents or four agents in Mississippi, and you know, how does that work out?
I'm going to ask Bob Gilpin to answer that question.
I think the best way to answer that is where we have a larger concentration of business as well as we have the concentration of agents. Some of these states are newer states for us, and we're building them out, and we're obviously adding agents as we go along, and those relationships are growing.
I see. So I guess what I was ultimately getting at is some of the business, like in Michigan or Georgia or Mississippi or Tennessee, these small states, is it being produced by agents outside the state,
yeah,
or is it actually coming from inside the state?
No, it's coming mainly from inside the state. Like Kevin and Mike has mentioned, you know, we see this very much as a local business, and that includes working with local independent agents. So as we go into a new territory and we expand, not only are we hiring locally, we're also appointing agents locally. And that's why you'll see it build out over time.
If you take a look at, Greg, at an office such as our Gulf South regional office, it was only open 2 years ago. So states such as Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana are immature.
And as we're adding agents, we're adding more agents in those states compared to a mature state like Pennsylvania.
Is the workers' comp market in those states more challenging or more troubled? Is it easier for entry to do this de novo entry into the marketplace, or is it better to acquire to get into the market? You know,
as you can see with our model, we've only done one acquisition. That was in the Midwest. And so we kind of went down two tracks, one organic, one on the M&A side. In general, the organic side has been much more attractive to us. And we're hiring local business leaders. We're getting really good referrals from Pennsylvania agents into those agents in those territories. And again, going back to Kevin's point on the state strategy assessment, you know, those states are being studied for multiple years before we decide to put capital into them. Yeah.
What is the biggest constraint on expanding that agent support more quickly? Is that a personal sell because there's only so much time you've got in the day?
It's really based on philosophy. So, I mean, our philosophy from the very beginning, and I was going to mention this in a few minutes, to do more with fewer relationships. We think we could bring a lot of franchise value by doing it that way. So, you know, we have a qualified team out there in the field working with agency partners, adding as we need them to meet our business goals and objectives, but it's really more of a philosophical. You can look at some of our competitors that have 8, 9, 10,000 agency partners. That's a lot to manage. And we don't think we get the same type of would get the same type of results if we use that model. We have very, very, very strong agency relationships. And, you know, for example, if we need help getting an injured worker back to their place of employment, we have some pull with an agency partner because we have so few and there is franchise value. If we had thousands of agency partners, we wouldn't have the same relationships and couldn't get those same type of results.
What is the pull with an agency partner? How does that get an injured worker back to work?
Well, I mean,
just give me an example of that.
So a mature relationship for us on the agency side is actually closer to $2 million in business.
Yeah.
And they value the Eastern relationship because, say, for example, in this area, there's only a few contracts. So obviously it's in their best interest to help us, you know, get somebody back to work because, you know, if the relationship isn't there, I can make one phone call and pick up a new agency partner by the end of the day today. So they're vested in our results and doing what's right, and likewise, we're vested in their results and doing what's right for them.
Mark, the only thing that I would add to your question with respect to agency expansion is just the qualitative standards that Bob and his team have, agency
right.
appointments, which are really high.
But is there much room to build out that rural strategy? I mean, is there in those rural markets, I assume your market share is quite small.
And I will comment on market share for you. There's a lot of very good opportunity to build out.
Right.
And as part of our...
As you sit here today, Ocala is not bigger. I mean, why are you... I'm just saying this before, but why are you going so slow?
Again, it's to continue with our philosophy, and we think we have the partners to meet our growth objectives, and, I mean, our track record shows that.
Right.
And in a long-tail line of business...
As you're doing that, what's your strength? Is it enough people to talk to them enough about it to convince them that they should adopt the philosophy, or you don't have enough time to find the brokers that share your philosophy? Or?
Well, again, we want to make sure that we are identifying and appointing the right agency partners because not everybody is, you know, focused on comp or understands the comp line as well as we do in some of our other partners. you know, we could easily triple our agency plant, but, you know, can we do that and gain the same results over a reasonable period of time? I'm not sure we can do that. So it's about profitable growth. Again, we mentioned we're a bottom-line company, so it's important that, you know, we add partners to help us improve and maintain the bottom line, not just the top line. Top line is easy. I mean, I can get us top line very, very quickly, but yeah, it's bottom line that we're most focused on. And, you know, going from $3 million in 98 to a little over $200 million last year is a pretty good track record on the growth side. And doing it profitably, there's not many companies that have been able to do it as profitable as we have over that period of time. So,
yeah, we're actually pretty boring on that side, Mark. I mean, we typically, just as I mentioned in my opening comments with our Lancaster office, we started at 3.2 million, went to 6, went to 10. It's really been the same thing in the Gulf South. As an example, first year was, you know, just kind of close to 4 million in revenue, and same type of traction this year. We're able to do it profitably with high quality service. And in my view, do it the right way. I don't think fast growth and workers' compensation is a great overall strategy.
And we are growing our agency network about 10, 12% a year, so we're definitely adding to it.
Yeah. With that, I'm going to, if it's okay with everybody, I'm going to
check and see if we have any online or calls, and then Chris has got a question. Caitlin, anybody queued up for a question from the dial-in?
Not at this time.
Okay, Chris.
So sort of going back to, you know, talking about your growth, you'd mentioned in alternative you're looking to grow the healthcare but also growing the non-healthcare business. Just as an overall strategy, how do you see your healthcare like business mix moving forward? Still in that 20% range or sort of expanding as a larger piece of the business?
Yeah. It's been very consistently 20% of our book for a number of years. I think at the end of the day, we would probably like to see healthcare grow a little bit more from a percentage basis than our other book, just because we have the tools in the toolbox now. I think I think one of the points that Kevin made earlier that's very compelling is if you look at healthcare organizations over the insurance and economic cycles, their two most difficult placements are medical professional liability and workers' comp. And I think if we can marry those two products and have some synergies, we can potentially see growth above our normal growth at Eastern. The only, Chris, the only damper to that, in my view, is I think our competitors have identified healthcare as a pretty attractive market. We do see some pretty good competition in that marketplace.
Where are your competitors?
It really varies by region, Greg. I mean, we have, you know.
Who are the top five guys that you're going up against? You see more often than not. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
the Mid-Atlantic is going to be one of your.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, on the stock carrier side, it's you know, Hartford, Travelers, you know, AIG, Liberty. On a regional basis, we see a number of group health companies that have gone into workers' compensation here in the Mid-Atlantic region, which you mentioned before. And again, it varies by region, but you can look at companies such as Accident Fund in the Southeast and others. So there's no lack of competition. I mean, Greg, I think there's 238 filed companies or so in Pennsylvania. So, and Bob, maybe you want to comment further on that.
Yeah, I think that's a good.
Yeah.
It varies by region, and again, you know, the way I look at it, we have national companies, regional companies, and then some small companies that are state-specific, but again, they vary by region for us, and we watch them very closely.
Christine?
I just have a quick numbers question. The 2% rate increase that you said, is that sort of keeping in trend with loss cost trends, or?
It very much is.
Okay. You're not getting any additional margin
above. What is it? Keeping with?
Yeah, it's covering our loss cost increases or our loss cost trends. Absolutely. And, well, yeah, and as a matter of fact, there's margin in there, too. I mean, when you look at, we'll talk about medical inflation and loss cost trends when Suzanne goes through her presentation. Don't want to steal her thunder, but our medical inflation trends have been fairly negligible over time. So it more than covers our loss cost trends, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Bob, did you have a question?
How much of a boost to ROE are you getting from the alternative markets?
In terms of percentages,
You know, I don't have that number in front of me, but it's something I can definitely get for you. What's interesting about alternative markets from an ROE perspective, there's so little of our own capital that's allocated to it. I could quote you a really high number because we're borrowing the capital from our customers and we're using the equity that was self-funded from their premium to calculate it. So by any measure, I really don't have, or we really don't have, any capital specifically allocated to it. So whatever we make is on our own capital of zero or a dollar. So it's a pretty significant number.
All right. So how much fee premium would you say? I mean, that would be the
fee-based revenue. I believe we disclosed in our 10K last year that our fee-based revenue was around $5 million.
And maybe alternatively, what's your ROE on your traditional book then?
ROE in the traditional book on allocated capital these days is very consistent with what ProAssurance is, and that is it's in the low double digits right now.
If you run just allocated capital, you always have to have a good allocated capital.
Right now, we're pretty much running with allocated capital. Okay, at this point in time, and a lot of questions were going his way, so this is very appropriate. I'd like to introduce Bob Gilpin, who's our Senior Vice President of Field Operations and Marketing. Bob?
Unfortunately, there's no slides in your package, just my picture, so we can turn that over. Like Mike and Kevin, I'll just give you a brief background. I've spent my entire career, which is 24 years, in the workers' compensation industry, so this is really all I've done. This is my third position. I started it in 1990 at Cigna, so I got some big company, that's back when I had a property and casualty business. So I got some big company experience on the claim side, the account management side. In 1995, I moved to PMA as a sales executive on the TPA side, and really more importantly, had the opportunity to work with Mike and Suzanne, and that brought me to Eastern, and I started here November 2nd of 1998. Like Kevin, I remember that date very well. I joined this company because I really thought, you know, as a younger person in the business at the time, it was a chance to do something very, very special. And if you look at the, you know, our history of startup to going public, to our partnership with ProAssurance, that is truly something special. While here, I've had the opportunity to work with small business, alternative markets, and I've always had the agency management marketing piece. And also at the moment, I'm managing field operations. Some strategic initiatives I have for myself and for my team, just to kind of dovetail off of some of the comments that Mike said. First and foremost, to achieve our regional business plans, and I'm going to talk about our regions and how we're doing. Execute our strategies for our very unique branding positions. We have a couple of different sub-brands out there, set us apart in the marketplace, and I just want to comment on those briefly. A very successful integration with ProAssurance, and specifically talking about taking advantage of cross-referral and cross-selling opportunities. And I'm happy to report that very early on, we've already appointed seven PR agencies, so agencies that we did not have in our network that were ProAssurance partners. We've added them, and we've written over $200,000 of premium, again, very early. And just very recently, we added two large deductible accounts, high ROE products for us, with ProAssurance introductions. So there are the strategic objectives that I'm focused on in 2014. I want to talk a little bit about our regional offices and field operations, and just thought I'd start with a few general comments for you to give you an idea of how field operations is performing. We're having year-over-year growth in all offices, and it's driven by the Mid-Atlantic and Gulf South, but all four regions are growing and growing nicely. We were very focused in the second quarter on increasing our premium retention. Mike alluded to a lot of competition to start the year. Retention wasn't quite where we had hoped. Spent a little more time with all of our folks and saw a nice rebound in the second quarter. We expect that to continue for the remainder of the year. Combined ratios, you know, not only are the combined ratio very impressive for the company over our history, but if you look at our four regions, it's very, very consistent. So they range from an 88.9 to a 93.6. So the four offices range from an 88.9 to a 93.6 as of June 30. And a good sign for us, and hopefully a good sign for the economy, positive audit premium across all four regions. So we're seeing an uptick in our audit premium.
An uptick as an acceleration as fast?
Yes. Yep. So.
And how did that affect you, you know, several years ago when audit premiums working against the industry? Was that pinching your...
Yeah, you know, Greg, just looking at it from a historical basis, we've had positive audit premium every year in the history of the company except 1 year. I think it was 2009, Kevin?
2010,
where it was minus $5,000 in premium for the year. So
$5,000,
yeah.
So break-even.
That's break-even.
Break-even. Yeah, so we have been, and again, Greg, that goes back to the broad class code diversification and really some very strong financial underwriting.
Just a comment or two on each region, the Mid-Atlantic, and I want to make sure you understand where we're primarily focused from a state strategy perspective. The Mid-Atlantic, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey. So they're the four states that we're primarily focused on. And Kevin already mentioned we have a regional office here in Lancaster and a satellite office out in the Pittsburgh area, Wexford. And the team out in Pittsburgh is actually pretty large, about 25 individuals. Very strong operational results. And the final comment there is New Jersey is one of our newer states, and it's actually been a very nice growth opportunity for us. So we're really expanding our Mid-Atlantic region by leaning on New Jersey and growing out that state. Southeast, we have five states that are primary target states, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, and Georgia. Main office in Charlotte, North Carolina, two satellite offices, one in Richmond, one in Nashville. I think that really gets back to comp as a local play. When you think about those five states, trying to manage from one office is just not possible. So we have our teams spread out over three offices.
Bob, can you give us a perspective on New Jersey, how you're going into that market? Because there's so many pre-existing strong relationships with existing insurance carriers in that state. How do you get into that market to access this better business, which presumably would be covered by other carriers?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, you know, we went through the state assessment strategy process and, you know, felt good about entering the state. You know, we looked at all the metrics. We did lean on several of our Pennsylvania agency partners that were already doing business in New Jersey, because obviously southeastern Pennsylvania is very close to New Jersey. And we used those folks to either give us references or help us write new business. And then we just followed our normal model by, you know, appointing agency partners that are focused on work comp and could provide us, you know, quality business. Interestingly, you know, we're active in 16 states across our platform. From a competition standpoint, New Jersey is actually one of the better states, meaning there's less competition.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, very pleased that we're getting some opportunity there. Believe it or not, some of the larger carriers are still hurting from Sandy a little bit, and they're very focused on that side of the business, and they've taken their eye off the comp ball, and it gives us a chance to get in there and prove ourselves, and it's worked out really, really well. Like New Jersey for the Mid-Atlantic, in the Southeast, South Carolina and Georgia for newer opportunities for us, and we're really seeing a nice build-out in those two states to supplement what we already have in place. The Midwest, Indiana, Michigan, and Kentucky are our three primary states. Up until this past July, we only had one office. That was the regional office in Carmel, Indiana, and very proud to report that on July 7th, we opened an office, a satellite office, in Granville, Michigan. So that's allowing us to focus on the surrounding communities in West Michigan, and that'll be our focus. So we like the environment in Michigan. Again, we had some relationships in Indiana that we're funneling into Michigan. We have a local team on the ground, and we feel it's going to give us some opportunities to grow the Midwest. The Gulf South, Mike alluded to, it's our newest region. That region began operations in 2013. They exceeded their business plan in the first year, and we're about, you know, 15-20% ahead of our business plan for 14 as of June 30th. So we feel really good about our progress there. And importantly, again, the combined ratio, the loss ratio results are in line with our other regions. So even though it's newer, we have our model in place, and we're seeing the same type of result. Primarily focusing on Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Alabama. And at the moment, we just have the one office, and that's in Madison, Mississippi, right outside of Jackson. Each region is managed by what we call a regional business executive. Okay, so while we give a lot of support and spend a lot of time out in the field, personally, I spend, you know, most of my time out in the field, we have hired local experts. And these local experts are responsible for their P&L, for staffing, for agency partnerships, and, you know, the execution of our service plan. So, again, it's a local play, and by having local experts out in the field managing the business for us, you know, we feel our results are better than others and sustainable, obviously, moving forward. The four individuals that are managing the regions have most have been with us for many years and have a lot of experience either with other companies and a few actually on the agency side as well. So it's just a breadth of experience that they bring to the table. And we spent a lot of time with them as a senior management team. And as we plan for the upcoming year, they're a big part of what's going to be happening in the regions. They let us know what's happening locally and where we can take advantage of business opportunities. Kevin mentioned this, you know, the local service strategy we're employing with this regional structure we have. Again, we view workers' comp as a local business, and we really feel the best way to manage it is with local experts, not only the regional business executives, but claims experts, underwriting experts, and risk management experts, and a marketing team to back them all up. So I think we've been a little bit redundant on the local piece, but we think it's a big part of our business, and hopefully you understand that as well.
So because you have this local approach, are you not using independent adjusters for any of your claims, or are you using all
No, never, no.
I won't even touch that one. Absolutely not. You will. That'll be very clear in a few moments. Okay, I want to just talk about market position in our top five states just to give you some color on where we are. And this information is from the best market share reports for 2013. Data lags a little bit. Pennsylvania, I would consider, is really our only mature state. We are the seventh largest writer at just about $120 million with a 4.6% market share. So we do think there are some additional growth opportunities, but, I mean, to be honest, they are somewhat limited. North Carolina, we're the 28th largest writer at a little over $13 million, and that gives us a 1% market share, just a 1% market share. We really like our opportunities there. Two of our largest agency partners company-wide have a significant presence in North Carolina. Indiana, we're the 14th largest writer at a little over $17 million, almost $18 million, with a 2.1% market share. I kind of view that as I do Pennsylvania, where there are growth opportunities, but they are somewhat limited. Virginia, we're the 24th largest writer, 8.6, 8.7 million, and we're actually under 1% on the market share. So there's definitely a lot of opportunity there. Virginia, very strong economy, and you know, we think there's a lot of good business potential, not only in the small business side, but in the medium and large as well. And again, we have the Richmond of that local market. And finally, Mississippi. I included Mississippi because it's one of our newer states, but in a region for us. We're the 28th largest writer at just under $3 million with a 0.9% market share. And if you think about the region, you look at Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Alabama, it's actually, if we write just 1% of the business there, it's $17 million. So to take our business plan up to $17 million in that region, just writing 1% is very doable, very possible, and I think even more opportunity moving forward. When you look at Michigan, getting back to just a few of the individual states I talked about as more recent growth opportunities, Michigan is a $1.1 billion market, and we're just brand new in that marketplace, so good opportunity there. Georgia, another very large state at $1.2 billion, and New Jersey at $2.2 billion. So when you look at Michigan, Georgia, and New Jersey, there's a lot of potential premium out there for us to write. And when you look at the agency partners and the plan we have in place, I think it's going to give us a lot of new business opportunities moving forward. So I'm going to switch gears and talk about marketing. And some of this we already kind of covered. Again, our philosophy on the agency management piece is fewer but more meaningful agency relationships. And we are looking for true partners. And that really means when we're out there searching for someone new to a point, it's an agency partner that really views workers' comp as a specialty line of business. They understand the importance of claims management, of risk management, of getting people back to work. If they're just looking for another market, if they're looking for another cheap price, you know, that's not our cup of tea, and we politely and very quickly walk away from that. But we are looking for partners that truly understand the business. You know, we think by doing that, you know, over the long term, we can have better outcomes, and it's been proven in our track record. Mike alluded to that we, you know, we're very detailed in going about appointments, and we take it very, very serious. We spend a lot of time doing our due diligence on new agency partners. Once we appoint them, I think we have a very tight process in place where we have an orientation for each and every new appointment, so they're required to sit through a couple-hour orientation process with us to really understand our philosophies and what we're trying to accomplish. There's a lot of personal interaction. You know, the beauty of having 205 agency partners is we can get out in front of them on a very frequent basis. If you have 9,000 agency partners, it ain't happening, you know, unless you have a ridiculous staff, which our competitors don't have. So personal relationships are very, very strong. With each and every agency partner, we do annual business planning, and we tie that back into our revenue plan for the company. So we validate our annual plan at the agency level, make 205 agency visits, and go through the plan with each and every one of them. Our agency partners get a detailed monthly reporting package. They know exactly where they stand, top line, bottom line, claims, larger claims, rate, retention. So there's never a question as to their results with these.
How many agent partners have you canceled in the last 5 years?
In the last 5 years, I don't know exactly, but in our history, roughly 48.
48.
They've all been mutual disengagements except for one. So I think, you know, that kind of speaks to the relationship and, you know, the clear objectives we put out there. And if the relationship is not going down the right path, whether it be from a revenue standpoint or a loss ratio standpoint, we put corrective actions in place. If we can't meet those corrective actions, you know, we always agree that we're going to, you know, go and separate ourselves and shake hands, and we've been able to do that in 47 out of 48 cases. So, very proud of that track record.
It's Greg, just to comment further on, it's primarily related to scale because we do want those larger relationships. So if we don't get to a really decent level of scale over three years, we typically agree to move to disengage.
That's 48 over 17 years.
Right.
Each region has an agency advisory council. We meet twice a year. We also have a president's council. We're getting a lot of good feedback on a regular basis. And, you know, personally, I make at least 100 agency visits a year. So not only is our marketing team out and very visible, I try to be very visible. Mike does a great job of being visible, Cindy, Kevin, and Suzanne. So, again, it's important, the relationship piece to us. We've already talked about the 205 contracts. And when you look at the average premium per contract, in the Mid-Atlantic, it's $1.9 million. I consider that a more mature market. The numbers are less than the other regions, but they're growing as the region grows. And we expect to get them up to, you know, that $1.5 to $2 million mark as well. We talk a little bit about agency expansion, and that really is tied to specific goals by region, and our regional business executives and our team put that together for us each and every year. Covered some of those items already. Any questions on agency management that we haven't covered or I haven't commented on? Okay. Branding, just very quickly going to touch on a couple of our branding initiatives. Kevin mentioned Inova, alternative markets. We've rebranded that. We feel really like we have some really unique attributes in the way we package and present our alternative market business, and that's why we felt it was important to rebrand it. Inova, there's a lot to that, but I'll just leave it at that. E-Covery. Return to work is really important in the work comp business. All of our competitors use return to work. We wanted to get away from just return to work. We went to a return to wellness model, and we've termed that e-covery. I'm going to leave that for Suzanne to comment on. It falls under her area.
Bob, can you maybe just mention how you guys market Inova versus the traditional comp program? You know, marketing the same broker, and I guess how do you get the brokers on board with getting to the Inova model?
We're very new into the process. A lot of it has to do with education, because while alternative markets, alternative insurance is a big part of what we do, the industry that we're in, not everybody truly understands captives or SPCs. So a lot of our materials and a lot of our time and attention is spent on education and bringing our agency partners up to speed so they can be experts out in the field with their customers, which ultimately benefits us. In addition, we have a lot of resources that we put out, some very traditional. We have videos, collateral, and a very rich website with all types of support materials.
But ultimately, is it the broker who's selling the client on the captive, or are you guys involved in that process as well?
I mean, ultimately, you know, we don't sell direct, so we do lean on the agency partner. That's what they're in place for. However, I would say that just about with each and every SPC opportunity, one of us is heavily involved in the sales process. And we're there as a partner with our agent to answer questions and take them through it.
And brokers and agents are becoming more and more comfortable with the models.
Absolutely.
And do they have any skin in the game, or can they get skin in the game as well?
Roughly half of our SPC programs, our agency partners have skin in the game. So you can imagine, Ryan, those folks understand the model really, really well. And, you know, so the time we spend with them and the way we market to them is a little different than maybe an agency partner that they're going through the process the first time. There, it's a lot of education, a lot of hand-holding. Once we get them through it, you know, they're amazed at what it brings to them and how it helps them expand their business, as Kevin mentioned, retain their business. Because once a customer gets in a sell program, very rarely do they leave.
I'm sorry if you mentioned this, but what's the magnitude of the growth there, you know, the increase in activity with the captive versus your core guarantee cost business?
I would say, you know, without having percentages and numbers in front of me, that we are seeing more opportunities in the SPC business than we are in our traditional business right now.
Do you think that's reflective of the market?
I think it's reflective of the market. I think it's reflective of the excitement on the part of agents and policyholders that Eastern is now part of the ProAssurance family for their healthcare customers. And I think a lot of it is just the Eastern and ProAssurance now reputation coming out in the marketplace. You know, we've really been incredibly successful. And I always tell people our best marketing tool is the money that we've made for our customers and the money that we've made in that business. And they're starting to really see it, and word's getting out.
Maybe it's a silly question, but just the mechanics of operating a captive and what you guys are offering, is it more of like a TPA environment where they're staying up their own independent insurance company and you guys act as the TPA almost, and is that where the fees are coming from?
30 seconds or less, because, you know, this could be a presentation in and of itself. We only do programs where it's fully bundled. So if you're the Pennsylvania Builders Association, to use Mike's example, Mike put that program on the books in 1999, we do the underwriting, we do the claims, and we do the risk management. And that's the only way we'll do the program, because we want to be able to control all of that. And by controlling all of that, we're able to produce better results. It's our reinsurance. And by the way, for doing all of that, there's a fee that we receive in the form of a ceding commission to the fronting companies. And in addition, and every segregated portfolio cell is statutorily protected from each other. So the way the five of us would describe this to a prospective customer is it's your own little insurance company. Quarterly financial statements, quarterly actuarial reviews, operational reports relating to claims, underwriting, risk management, full marketing tools. They get all of the benefits of the ProAssurance model overlaid over a segregated portfolio cell for a fee, obviously. And in certain cases, we'll say this is, you know, something we're really interested in. They can't provide all the collateral up front necessarily, and we'll say, well, you know what, we'll own 50% of that. So in that case, we'll get the fee-based revenue like we normally would. But on the underwriting side, we'd own 50% of the SPC through a preferred share, and the customer, in my example, would own 50% of the SPC. So we'd be taking underwriting risk on that. And our reinsurance structure, which has both per occurrence retentions with limits of $150 million for each cell, not aggregated in the lease, and then aggregate reinsurance on top of that on a program year floating ag basis over every one of our cells. And lastly, I get a little excited about all that. To put it all into perspective, we have underwritten from 1999 to June 30th of 14, 166 program years, and we've never drawn on a letter of credit, knock it on wood. And the reason why we've never had to draw on a letter of credit is because we control the underwriting, Suzanne controls the claims, Cindy does the risk management and the underwriting and the reinsurance, and quite frankly, every one of us in this room are integrally involved in these programs. And as you can see, it correlates well to one of the other questions about educating the agents. It's a long educational process, and you have to educate the policyholders because in most cases they're directly involved in taking the risk.
I want to get a question real quick. How do you allocate costs, right, because you're doing the underwriting, you're doing the management, you're out in the claims, to those cells when you charge them, right? Because there's a quarter of your business is the alternative. How do you make sure that you're charging your appropriate expense level, including overhead, to the
We have detailed models from a budget perspective, from a forecasting perspective, where we're able to say, and all of the charges to the customers in this case are a percentage of premium, and we know what it costs us, you know, to handle a claim for a medical only versus an indemnity claim. We know what our risk management expenses are, and we're able to look at those per unit costs and determine what we think is an appropriate percentage of premium cost to charge to those customers. And, you know, there's fronting fees for doing the underwriting and collecting, billing and collecting premium. There's a percentage of premium fee for handling the claims. There's the same thing for risk management. And to the customer in the SPC, it's shown as a ceding commission. So we don't actually allocate costs specifically to that cell so much as we charge them a ceding commission that we believe is representative of what our costs are and what a appropriate margin is on top of that for the customers. And we do that for every single sale.
So what is the appropriate margin? How much does the ceding commission exceed the cost that the cost of goods sold, essentially?
Probably by about 15 percentage points.
15 points of total premiums, total subject premiums?
So for taxes.
Your total ceding commission is going to be 30 to 35 points?
In some cases, you're in the ballpark, absolutely. So a fair amount of it sticks to our ribs.
Well, another way to say that's why your expense ratio is so low.
Are you allocating yourself there?
When we look at the overall structure of the company, and we look at what we need to charge a customer for an alternative market or an Enova program, I got to get more used to that. We look at every single cost in the company.
Well, just one addition to that. I mean, it's all – think about it as a pre-renewal process or pre-prospect. It's all – you're sitting down in a room and you're really doing ground-up, right, expense pricing. So you find out what the expectations are of the customer. You know, do they want quarterly claims meetings? Do they want risk management activity? And you build that pricing in plus the corporate loads for what Kevin said. And that's how we price them. And we have the ability to adjust that over time. So the nice thing about the Eastern model, our first two customers, we have 100% program retention rate for kind of a long period of time now. But our first two customers that started with us in 1999, 2000 are still with us with very strong equity positions. So that business has been really, really special.
I think the question I'm having is not necessarily an Eastern, it's more of an industry issue.
Yeah.
We often find that the costs are not, they're difficult to allocate between alternative and not alternative.
Yeah.
And you have $5 million of revenue from alternatives, you've got $200 million from,
yeah.
Right? That $5 million, you know, it doesn't actually take that much of your time to make the profit margins on that shrink a lot.
Sure.
You have a relatively large number of people who are not fully being allocated. So that's the question I'm asking. You could actually be losing money on that.
No.
We couldn't tell from the outside.
Not that we can obviously share this information with you because we can't, but we look at it quarterly. And we have specific models that look at the profitability of every one of our products separately. including alternative markets. And it was interesting because Bob asked the question about ROE, and we always have something at the bottom of this particular model that says, well, here's how much money we make, but the ROE is like infinity because we don't have any hard dollars allocated to it, which is why it was tough for me to answer your question.
Did you put the – is the fronting fee part of the ceding commission? Or
it is.
In addition to?
It's part of the ceding commission. So the ceding commission is reinsurance costs that we charge. It's a pass-through. Agent commissions. The three functions I just mentioned, being fronting, which is underwriting, risk management claims, there's a sell rental fee that stays, and that's a piece that stays at the core of Eastern Re, and then there are premium and excise taxes, which are pass-throughs as well. And I don't think I missed anything. Yeah.
It used to be a premium. If this is a guaranteed policy, and it was $100 in premium, company who's up to be paying. If they do this alternative sell structure, how much are they paying, you know, relative to that $100?
Sure.
And then your revenue obviously would be 100, but what's your revenue in the second scenario?
Yep, I guess what I would say there, she's a $100 policy. It is a guaranteed cost policy.
Right.
We seed it down to a segregated cell at Eastern Re. And let's just say the seeding commission is 40%. And if this customer owns 100% of that cell, and that includes reinsurance, which is, you know, double digits, low double digits, if that customer does not have a loss, which, by the way, Suzanne will tell you, never happens in workers' comp, they would pocket $60, and their insurance cost for that would be $40,
right,
using that example. And of that 40%, the revenue that really sticks to our ribs is about 15 percentage points of that 40 points.
Right.
So we would have $15 of revenue off of that 100 to kind of correlate back to Greg's example. It's been a wonderful product for us. It's going to be an even better product for us prospectively for all of the reasons that I had talked about. And for a monoline workers' comp and a monoline MPL company to have this kind of product makes us very unique.
Are you limited in some ways the capacity to be able to put the cells into the reinsurance company? Like, is there a certain number of cells that you have to keep it under?
No. The answer is no. We present a business plan to the Cayman Island Monetary Authority. And we go through all of the underwriting rigor that Suzanne and the claims and the marketing pieces that Bob talks about and do financial due diligence on the owners. We want to make sure that they're able to provide the appropriate collateral. I'd say, you know, two things. So the answer to your question is no. And the second thing I would say is we've never gone to a regulatory body in the Cayman Islands and been denied an SPC because they didn't feel like we had the expertise or it wasn't the right structure or the potential sell owner didn't have the financial wherewithal to support the program.
Obviously, Bob, in the underwriting process, we don't believe a group will qualify for that. We don't present it. We would decline.
Yeah. So we could have 50 of them someday.
You want to have 50 of them.
Yeah. Well, that would be a good thing.
Yes, we do.
We're not quite there yet.
And that's why we've rebranded. And also the exchange we just had about the education is exactly why we rebranded. So this is wonderful. I want to just make two more quick comments. Another area that we rebranded, small business, we formerly called it Select. Everybody out there calls it Select. You know, we think we're very unique in how we offer our small business product. So we call it Unity. And we have a whole Unity community and all kinds of really neat things built around it. But, you know, importantly for you, it has helped set us apart in the marketplace. And early results year over year, that book is up 11%. The business is up 11%. And when you look at segments in our business of profitability, small business is one of, if not the most profitable segment of our business. So by spending the extra time and effort to promote and generate additional opportunities in small business really has benefited us.
And how do you define small business? Is it
for us? I mean, everybody does a little bit differently, but under $20,000 a premium. And, you know, Mike mentioned back in the day, obviously that's the only place we could play.
Yeah.
So it really is the foundation of the company. It's an important part of our history. Those customers have been wonderful to us. And, again, we'd love to grow grow more of it, but because it's such a crowded space, we had to set ourselves apart.
So we all want to welcome you to the Unity community now that you're here today.
Finally, I'll just mention parallel pay, because in our industry, it's kind of a pay-as-you-go. Work comp is a pretty big theme these days, and thankfully we have the ability to compete with our branded position of parallel pay. We launched our offering in April of 2009, did our first $10 million about a year later at $20 million in 2011. And just to catch up to speed, last year we finished at $30.2 million, and we expect to grow that this year. So of our $200 million last year, roughly $30 million came through our parallel pay product. So it's really helped us compete. It's helped us save business where they were looking to, where our customers were looking to go on a pay-as-you-go platform. We can now offer that. And importantly, it's really helped us to attract new business. When you look at retention, when you look at results, they're in line with our overall book of business. Actually, the retention is a little bit better. So I have a lot of other comments there, but, you know, given the time, I'll just leave it at that unless you have any questions.
Okay, let's open up the phone lines and see if we've got anybody who would like to queue up to ask Bob any questions. I don't see any coming in online.
As a reminder, it is star one to ask a question, star one. And we do not have any questions at this time.
Very good.
With that, we'll flip to the next slide to definitely a better-looking picture, and Suzanne Emmett, our Senior VP of Claims. That's where that's at.
All right. Thank you, Bob. Again, by way of my background, I'm a graduate of Franklin Marshall College, which is just up the street from where we're sitting today. I started my career with PMA Insurance Group in 1986 as a multi-line claims trainee, and immediately fell in love with my new career. So I've stuck around with that for 28 years. I became the regional claims manager for PMA in 1992, and it was at PMA in 1995 that I met Mr. Boguski when we worked together in the Harrisburg regional office. And it was in December of 1997 that he invited me to join him over the tattoo parlor to get Educators Alliance Insurance Company up and running. And I started with the company on December 8th of 1997, and I will be forever grateful to Mike for making that phone call, because it's been just a wonderful 17 years here at Eastern. So I always start every talk about our claims model with this phrase: an old claim is a bad claim, and a closed claim is a good claim. And everything that we do in the claims organization is built around that premise. Workers' comp claims do not get better as they get older. You can wish for it. You can hope that it happens, but it's just not going to happen. So we have a very disciplined, very holistic claim management model based on that concept of closing claims. And a few of the key points of that are prompt reporting and immediate investigation, because if you think about it, properly closing a claim starts at the beginning. It starts with how you onboard that claim and start to investigate it and manage it from day one. And then aggressive ongoing management, always focused on return to wellness every step of the way, every thought, everything we do. Medical management and preventing a disability mindset in the injured worker. And I'll talk more about some more specifics on our medical cost management initiatives in a few minutes. And then a very proactive plan of action focused claims management model, so that every time one of our claims people touches their claim, looks at their claim, they're thinking all the time about, what's my exposure? How am I going to manage this claim to a resolution? How am I going to impact the outcome on this claim? So our goal is to get injured workers healthy, get them appropriate medical care, and achieve our favorable outcomes by quickly and safely getting them back to work and on with their lives. And from our perspective, that equals a closed claim, and that's a very good thing. We call ourselves, we like to call ourselves, a short-tailed writer of workers' comp. We would love it if you all could call us that as well. But just referring back to Kevin's slides, on pages 20 and 25, Kevin said that those are two of his favorite slides. I actually like to frame those and hang those on the wall of my office. And now that my children are grown, I may send them out as my Christmas cards this year because I also love those slides because they really capture very nicely in one succinct little picture what it is that we are trying to do in the Eastern Claims Department. And just sort of giving you a different view of those numbers, looking at the slide on page 20 of our traditional business, we've got over 97% of our 2012 and prior year claims closed as of June 30th of 2014. Almost 94%, if you add 2013, just the very most recent accident year that we're managing, we've got over 94% of those claims closed at June 30th as well. And as Kevin mentioned, in alternative markets, arguably a little bit tougher book of business, the results are just slightly better at 98% of 2012 and prior and 94.6% of 2013 and prior year claims closed. We talk about closing claims all the time. We talk about strategies to get people better and get them back to work. It's embedded in our day-to-day activities. In 2013, we closed 62.1% of the claims that were open at December 31st of 2012. So by the end of 2013, we had closed 62.1% of all the open claims from the year before. And as of June 30th of this year, we had closed 32.2% of the claims that were open at 12/31/2013. We're coming into the end of the year, and so while it's every day we close claims, coming into the end of the year is definitely we find greater opportunities to get claims settled because people would like to have a little lump sum perhaps. Headed into the holidays, and the attorneys like to get things closed out as well. So we'll be starting some activities soon to do an extra little push there. We resolve the claims using every strategy that we can. So when I say resolve, most of the time what that means is that we do what workers' comp is supposed to do, which is help someone get better and go back to work. If necessary, we use full and final lump sum settlements to get claims closed if there is not another way to do it, or if we see that maybe the person is not 100% recovered, maybe not fully back to their full-time job, if we think that there's some potential for that claim to reopen in the future, we'll also do a lump sum settlement on those claims as well. Because when the claim is closed, we want it to stay closed. So in those jurisdictions where there's potential for the claims to reopen, if we see the potential for that with a less than full recovery, we'll do some small settlements just to make sure that it's full and final. They cannot come back and reopen that claim. And when I say full and final, I mean medical and indemnity.
I think oftentimes you have closed and settled. And some insurance companies treat those different too. And then, of course, you have, sometimes there are other insurance companies, when they actually not paying.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk about the definitions of Eastern? When you talk about a closed claim,
mm-hmm.
a settled claim, and then what do you call it when you actually don't pay any money?
Here they're pretty much the same thing. What we close a claim when we do not believe that there is any further exposure on that claim. So, for example, the difference between a settled claim closed claim and one that we're just not paying on anymore. We've got some open claims in those back years sitting there where we're not paying anything right now. However, there are a couple of them where at the time they were not willing to, they didn't want to settle their medical. But there was a big exposure on the indemnity, and we didn't see the exposure on the medical, and so we took the opportunity to cap the indemnity exposure and settle just that part of the claim. These people haven't treated for 6, 7, 8 years, but we know that at the time we settled the indemnity, that there was the potential that, you know, this guy is going to need a total hip at some point. He probably will need a total hip at some point. That claim is sitting there open because we know there's the potential, and it's reserved for what a total hip. Now, we still contact him on a regular basis and offer him some money. And over time, I'll tell you, that strategy has proven very successful because you catch them on the right day when they've just gotten the flyer with all of the new large screen 3D TVs, and they think, you know what, I'd like one of those. And my adjuster just called and offered me some money. And you catch them on the right day, and you speak to a need or a motivation that they have, and they settle their claim. So we close it when we do not think we have further exposure on that claim.
Further
payments to make, yes.
Which makes it harder to close claims lately? I mean, you're doing a good job, but I'm just sort of wondering what the puts and takes are in today's environment, legal, medical, what's making it harder to close claims?
There's one fairly easy answer to that, and that is Medicare. Medicare and their more structured requirements over the past 10 years or so, that there be formal Medicare set-aside arrangements done to fund for Medicare's potential future exposure on injuries that should be paid by other payers. Are you all familiar with that concept? It's relatively a deep and complicated concept, but in a 2-minute answer, Medicare's a secondary payer. What they saw happening was that claims were being settled by liability carriers, comp carriers, and they were basically offloading the future medical exposure for some pretty significant injuries to Medicare. So Medicare put in place this model, this review model, where they said for settlements above a certain amount, for people that fit certain criteria, if you are going to settle the medical, you need to consider Medicare's interest. And one of the ways that we do that is through doing a formal Medicare set-aside proposal. We look at what we think the future medical will be for this person. We submit that to Medicare. Medicare reviews it, and they say, yep, that's right. You got the right number?
Is there an age cutoff for that, or is it everybody?
No, it's a certain age. It's not even really an age. It's is someone Medicare eligible? Do they expect to be Medicare eligible within the next 18 months? Is the settlement over $250,000? It's a bunch of criteria. But so that makes it harder, obviously, with medical being
a... Is it getting worse and worse every year, harder and harder?
I think...
Do they sort of squeeze you with some hidden regulations every year?
Is it getting harder, harder, easier? You know, it changes because they kind of change their rules. But as long as you do the right things, kind of stay on top of it, manage your claims appropriately, you can get through it. It doesn't prevent us from settling claims, but it definitely makes it harder for us to settle claims.
They're changing their rules, though. It's probably putting more onus on you to make sure
it is.
You're funding more.
It is. But on the positive side, there have been introductions of some appeal procedures. You know, up until recently, if you said we think it's $10,000 and they said we think it's $1 million, there was no appeal. There was nothing you could do about that. And so they are building in some.
How about from a legal standpoint, state regulations? Are those getting more challenging for you?
Again, it's kind of state by state. Some states are passing reforms that make things a little bit easier. Some states are passing reforms that
overall,
are...
Overall, how do you feel about
it? Overall, I think that we feel good about the states that we're in. As part of that state assessment process that we do, the claims environment and the provisions of the law that allow us to use our medical cost management strategies to get people back to work and to settle claims are three of the most important things that we look at when we go into a state. So I feel really good about the states that we're in and our ability to overlay our model and continue to get the same kinds of results. It's all claims is a hard business. It's always hard. It's just hard in a different way on any given day. It's harder than when I was sitting at a claims desk, I'll tell you that. And that was a long time ago. Harder than last year? No. Nope, not harder than last year. But we are a very tough bunch. Another key element of the model is that differentiates us is how we staff our claims department. And this goes back a little bit to my response to Greg's question about do we use independent adjusters or TPAs, and we don't. Our own claims people sit in our local, regional, and satellite offices and manage our claims. These are people they have the jurisdictional expertise, they have relationships in the workers' comp community, they build relationships with their agents and with their customers, they know the medical community, they know the attorneys, they know the judges or commissioners. So that's really important. We have this wonderful claims management model that we can overlay on any jurisdiction, with a few tweaks here and there. It's the people sitting out there in those local offices who know the details. Because, like everything else in claims, the devil's in the details. And you need them to be able to take our mindset and apply it to what their state allows them to do or not do. So that is really important to us, that it's our people who feel a real vested interest in getting the outcomes on the claims. We keep our caseloads very low. And we control and monitor how many new claims are being assigned to everyone because we want them to have time to do both things. I talked about how closing a claim properly starts at the beginning. We want them to really dig into every new claim and have the time to do it. We also keep their pending claims low so that they can give the attention they need to aggressively managing claims toward resolution.
What's the turnover in your claims department?
It's very low. It's very low. We treat people with respect. We give them good tools to do their job. We make them feel good about what they do. We don't, we don't manage them by keystrokes per minute or how many forms did they fill out. While we have very objective measurements, we tell them, you know what, you come in every day to make a difference in people's lives. Because you are going to get them better and get them back to work, and you should feel good about that. I don't know how many insurance companies you would walk into where they say, we want our claims people to feel good about the job they're doing every day and the difference they're making in people's lives. So we have really low turnover.
What's the caseload ratio?
It varies by region. In the Mid-Atlantic, it varies by region because of the state provision. So in some states, you need lower caseloads to do everything, direct medical care and things. So in the Mid-Atlantic, it's just over 100 per claim rep. In the Midwest and the Southeast, they're around 75, give or take a couple of claims. There's a lot more proactive direction of care or pre-approval of medical treatment in those jurisdictions, so we need them to have a little bit more time to do that. And in the Gulf South, it's 33 because there are 33 claims and there's one person. So the average caseload is 33. And she is just going to town on those claims. I can tell you that right now. You back to work? Back to work? You back to work?
Put a number around the question, yes, on turnover. On page 12, there's our regrettable turnover is 4.4% over
company-wide.
Company-wide, and the claims operation would be consistent with that number.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. So again, the low case loads, and this is again a kind of another one of the key phrases that we talk about, like an old claim is a bad claim and a closed claim is a good claim. You know, we teach our claim reps that this is what we want going through their mind all the time. Where have I been? Where am I going? How am I going to get there? How much is it going to cost me? So that's their, in a nutshell, that's what they're, you know, that's what they're held accountable for every day. It's the way we have them document their files. It's the way we have them trained to think about their files. It's all part of the same process for them. They're not looking at managing tasks or pieces of mail or, again, keystrokes per minute or I need to fill out this report. They're thinking about how am I going to impact the outcome on this claim. Medical cost management is a huge piece of what we do. You know workers' comp, and you know that back in the good old days, medical was a relatively small piece of a workers' comp claim, and indemnity was a bigger piece, and that has slowly moved, and it continues to move in the direction of making medical a bigger and bigger piece. So as Kevin mentioned, one of the things that I work very hard on is managing our medical inflation trend. As he said, it's been relatively negligible. It's been flat, slightly up, slightly down over the course of our history. So, the way we do that, first and foremost, closing our claims. Closing claims early and often is the best way to control medical inflation because people who are back to work and all better, guess what, they don't treat. And as claims get older, you'll see, early in a claim, a lot of medical treatment, then it goes down, it levels off. You get out into those out years, 5, 6, 7 years, guess what happens to medical treatment? Boom. It goes up, and it just goes up and up and up and up because all kinds of things have gone wrong at that point in the claim. So close our claims early and often, number one way to control medical inflation.
An idea as to what percentage of the overall claim you guys now would be medical versus indemnity?
Mm-hmm. We're overall, just in general, we would be roughly around that 60% medical, 40%, company-wide. It varies, again, by jurisdiction, but we're right about there.
Do you ever have any issues with claims that close reopen?
No, not as Kevin said. Maybe we within a couple of months. Somebody who was fully recovered at MMI back to work, they go back for another recheck. But no, not major reopen claims. No. Let's see. But that being said, we do close a lot of claims, but we are a workers' comp carrier, and so a lot of medical bills and medical treatment come across our desks every day. So managing that existing medical component is a huge part of what we do. We have all of the usual things, a full suite of, national network programs. We've got, preferred provider networks. We've got bill review software. We've got specialty networks. We've got pharmacy benefit management. So we've got all of those things in place, and they've all been put in place to ensure that they're national in scope so that as we do our geographic expansion, we're not going out to build something as we go into a new state. All the basics are there. Everything is there for us to be able to manage medical costs. But you can't just managing medical costs and comp is not just about having networks and getting discounts. Because if you're not minding the store in terms of how much people treat or the kind of treatment they get, if you're just worried about getting discounts, you're not going to manage your medical costs and workers' comp. So we put also some very specific programs in place by state where we can, based on the provisions of that state. If we know that we can, really go to town on managing physical medicine costs, we'll put some extra controls or extra programs in place in those states. But, you have to have a relentless focus, continuous focus on medical cost management. And I describe it as a game of whack-a-mole. Have you ever seen that game at, like, carnivals where the little moles pop up and you've got a hammer? And that's medical cost management and workers' comp because you've got it under control over here, and guess what happens? Compounded drugs, boom, come up over here. We get a handle on compounded drugs, and over here there's, opioids coming up over here. So It's always a hammer. My goal is to have a hammer for every mole, and that's what we're trying to build, except they keep adding more moles. And so that's what makes my life difficult. But, you know, we look at what are the new trends, you know, where are costs popping up, what are we coming across the country, what started on the West Coast, and we know it's coming this way.
What kind of got your attention lately?
Compounded drugs, opioids and chronic pain, medical marijuana.
Is that still off, or is that drug addiction?
You know what, it's still enormous. It's still an enormous problem, but it's getting a lot of attention, and you are starting to see companies putting controls in place.
Do you drug test the people who are
taking
them?
It depends on the state. We can't make it happen in some states, but as a best practice, we do ask for the treating physician to do random drug screens. We ask them to do, you know, those contracts with folks when they're prescribing opioids. A lot of it depends on physician, you know, dispensing. So those are the things that right now have our attention. So we're always looking, never satisfied, never complacent. Oh, flat is good, because the minute you think flat is good and you think you've got it all covered, there it goes again. So we never sleep when it comes to medical cost management and the programs we put in place. You know, we've got some. So we've put some nurses into our model. We have nurses who do triage and early intervention. So every new lost time claim, a nurse is making the initial contact with the injured worker. They are talking to people more about their health than, you know, an adjuster calls and they investigate the claim. What happened? The nurse calls and talks about. We've got about 20 key medical and biopsychosocial attributes that the nurses are wanting to talk about. So they're asking them about pre-existing conditions. They're asking them about, smoking, illegal drug use. What other drugs do they take? Do they have a history of depression? They're really getting a picture for us of what are we dealing with here? Because a workers' comp claim that's going to go wrong is about way more than what happened, how this person broke their leg. It's about this person. And so our model is built to identify, give me a clearer picture of this person. And if there are some things going on here that I know are correlated with that claim going in the wrong direction, the sooner I know that, the more controls I can put around that and be more vigilant about watching things happen that push that claim in the wrong direction. So they're doing a wonderful job of identifying that, and then we can really be aware of anybody want to guess what the number one correlated condition or element is that correlates most highly with a claim that's going to be expensive and go in the wrong direction?
Follow the
Kardashians. We're going to put that in our model. We're going to put that in there. How much reality TV do you watch? Anybody? Smoking. Number one correlation with a claim that is going to be more expensive and go in the wrong direction. All kinds of reasons for that we can talk about later.
Back to work, the employers and the brokers. Cooperating is the primary, and it gets still back to work. Like, do their economic impact on that?
Yep, absolutely. I can talk about eCovery, which Bob mentioned, which is our return to wellness model. And again, getting people back to work, number one way to control medical costs on an ongoing claim, because guess what? Once they go back to work, they don't have to treat anymore. Miraculously, they don't go to the doctor anymore. So return to work was always part of our culture, and everybody talks about it in workers' comp. Return to work, return to work. As Bob said, we feel and know that we do it better, so we branded it as eCovery Return to Wellness. We have a return to wellness specialist. We created that position in 2011. Her full-time job, 100%, is developing strategies, tools, conversations, materials around how do we do a better job of getting people back to work, return them to wellness. It goes to another one of Greg's questions about what do your agents have to do with getting somebody back to work? Return to work, return to wellness is not just a claims responsibility at Eastern. It's everyone's responsibility. So if the claim rep is making that phone call to the injured worker, to the employer, and the employer says, nope, don't have modified duty. And the claim rep says, well, geez, it says right here when we wrote your policy that you provide modified duty. And they say, well, we didn't mean for this guy. We meant everybody else. We're not bringing this guy back to work. So they talk to the underwriter, and they say, give that agent a call and have them. The agent's got a relationship maybe with better than we do with that customer. The agent gives the customer a call and says, do you know what this is going to do to you financially? Do you know what's going to happen to the reserves on this claim if you don't bring this person back to work? So they can come at it from a different angle from what the claims department does, and it's a really successful model. But claims is not left at Eastern kind of holding the bag on you know, failure to provide return to work. We really all jump on it and get involved. You know, we've tried to change the dialogue around return to work with our return to wellness model. What you hear talked about in the industry is, you know, it's focused on the employer, and it's all about their cost. Return to work is good for reducing your cost, reduce your mod, reduce your premium. We've made it a conversation about it's the right thing to do. Getting people back to work is the right thing to do. Work is good. Work is good. Kevin mentioned the billboards. Don't let them make you go back to work. You're entitled to a lump sum settlement. You know, work is evil. Work is not evil. And so our conversation is around, you know what, here's all the great things about returning to work. This is really better for you. It's better for you, Mr. Employer, you, Mr. Agent, you, Mr. Injured Worker. So eCovery has been so well received by customers, by agents, by our own people, have really embraced that concept of it's not just about return to work and closing the claim. It really is about getting someone back to their life, getting them on with their life. A workers' comp claim doesn't have to be life-altering for people. So, you know, the holistic approach that I've talked about, claim closings, you know, our disciplined claim management model, our robust and evolving game of whack-a-mole with medical cost management strategies, eCovery, it's kind of the story behind the numbers that you all see. You know, you look at our loss ratio, you see our claim closing results. You know, it really is how we reduce disability duration, save on medical costs, control inflation, and hopefully now you've maybe got a little more insight into what goes into that from a claims perspective.
Let's open the phone lines and see if we have any phone calls from or any questions from those dialed in. I do not see any coming in online.
As a reminder, it's star one to ask a question, star one. And there are no questions at this time.
All right.
I'll pass.
Okay, Bob's got one.
It might be helpful if you can maybe put into context your claims figures versus what the industry is like.
Mm-hmm.
We hear 97% of the claims closed from, you know, this
yeah.
year.
That. Yep, yep.
But how do we compare that to what the norm is?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to take a whack at?
Sure. I mean, you know, the loss ratios speak for themselves, which is the whole model. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of claim count information that's available. And the claim count would be a factor of whatever the exposure was in that year. So even if it was available, you'd probably have to, you know, calculate some percentage. From the little bit that we've seen, so the short answer is we don't have any good data. From the little bit that we've seen, you know, in going to investor presentations and things like that where they have it, is we're significantly shorter than the industry. The feedback that we've received from Pricewaterhouse, who are our former auditors, and their actuarial department, from Ernst & Young, and quite frankly from AM Best, who finally a couple years ago put the words short-tailed in our AM Best rating rationale, is that we significantly outperform the industry from a claim count perspective. And again, we already know that we outperform the workers' comp industry by a wide margin, another word that AM Best used, from a loss ratio perspective. So unfortunately, I can't answer your question, but just give you a little bit of that color around it.
Basically, the results speak for themselves.
The results speak for themselves.
Right.
And has there been, have you seen any impact from healthcare reform on the claims process at this point?
At this point, no, not really. I think that, you know, we've been seeing some changes in, you know, healthcare delivery over the past few years, independent of healthcare reform, and there's an awful lot of dialogue about how is it going to impact, you know, suggestions from, you know, it'll be better because people will be healthier because of all the wellness provisions, to it'll be worse for workers' comp because there will be a diversion of care to workers' comp because providers are getting paid less on the group health side, and so in some states, workers' comp is sort of the last bastion of capitalism and fee schedule-less provision of care. But you just don't know, and it's also going to depend on states and how much control you have around medical costs. Okay. No other questions, I would be delighted to introduce you to Cindy Sklar, who's our Senior VP of Underwriting and Risk Management.
Thank you, Sue. Good morning, everyone. I've been in the industry 27 years. I started after graduating with a Bachelor of Science in Safety Science. I started at Hartford as a loss control rep and worked there for 4 years and then joined EBI Companies, which was a monoline workers' comp writer. And there I did loss control, account management, started venturing into underwriting, and also did agency management and marketing. I have a certified safety professional designation as well as an associate in risk management. And unlike Bob and Suzanne, I actually did not work with Mike before, but I certainly knew of him by reputation because insurance is a local play in a small community. So I'll just say that Mike and I were fierce competitors because we were both going after every large account in central Pennsylvania together.
Sometimes you have to take out the enemy.
So very, very fortunately for me, a mutual friend that Mike and I share connected the two of us back in 1999, and we sat down and had lunch with Bob, and I joined Eastern shortly thereafter and have been very pleased to be a part of this. And since the inception, I've worked very closely with Mike. Mike, for most of the years, served as the chief underwriting officer up until a few years ago when he turned that over to me. But, you know, from day one, Mike and I worked together on developing the underwriting strategies, and one of the main reasons I was brought on board was to develop the risk management strategies for the company as well. Talk a little bit first about underwriting, and then I'll cover risk management and end with that. But a lot of what you've heard from Mike, from Kevin, from Bob, Suzanne, has already outlined our underwriting philosophy. And our philosophy is very simple. You know, you've heard us say we're a bottom-line company. Our underwriting philosophy is don't stretch. Short, sweet, to the point. Don't stretch, don't chase top-line revenue, don't stretch on pricing, don't stretch on making a decision to insure a risk that you're really not quite certain of. And that culture of a very strong underwriting discipline is pervasive throughout our organization. Since day one, we've employed an individual account underwriting strategy. You know, if there's one very important thing Mike taught me very early on, it was the importance of book diversification. And if you look historically at our results, you can certainly see the benefit that that diversification has brought to us in terms of stability of our results over insurance cycles, over economic cycles. It's really been one of the key strategies for us being successful in that area. You've heard already rural focus, but I'm going to say it again because, again, it's such an important part of how we do business. And our underwriting team is very focused on rate adequacy. And when we don't feel we can get the right rate for an exposure on a risk, we maintain that discipline and we walk away. Again, don't stretch to chase top line because it's really about the bottom line results that we're going to deliver to Eastern. I'll say we have an exceptionally talented underwriting staff. And some of that are people that we've brought in with lots of experience who truly align and embrace our underwriting philosophy, and part of our model has been to grow and develop talent internally as well. We couple that underwriting talent with a lot of proprietary software and business intelligence applications. So, you know, you've heard Kevin talk about how we write in over 600 class codes, and think, wow, how do you do that? But we have business intelligence tools that drive class-specific information to an underwriter's desktop so that then when they're reviewing a potential opportunity, they can literally click a few buttons, punch in a number, hit enter, and get all of our historical information on that class delivered to their desktop within a second. So it's a phenomenal tool. And when we look at our diverse book and how we underwrite that, again, trying to reinforce, to us it's not always as important what the business does, but it's, are they local? Who's the agency partner that brought us the opportunity? Because they're kind of our frontline underwriting defense. 205 large, meaningful relationships. They know what we like, and they're going to put their best business with us. And then thirdly, we're looking at the merits of that individual risk. We want to understand their exposures, understand their controls, understand their level of interest in being proactive with loss prevention measures, fully understand their commitment to our e-covery process from day one. We're not waiting until a claim happens to find out if someone's going to work with us on e-covery. We're asking that question on the underwriting side up front. And if the answer is no, again, that discipline, walk away. Because we know that that's a key part of our profitability. The approach that we have with that individual account underwriting philosophy and not targeting specific classes has been a huge advantage to us as opposed to our competitors, because underwriting is somewhat of an art, and we have the talent and the tools to find opportunities that a lot of other carriers are going to kick out of their underwriting box. Their box is this. They'll go after everything that fits in the box. But there are a lot of good and high-margin business opportunities around the fringe of that box. So the talent that we have with the people and the systems enables us to go after those high-margin opportunities. So I will say that on the underwriting side, we use a lot of data to help us make informed, quick, accurate decisions. And we really think that strategy hasn't just helped us with, you know, producing exceptional loss ratios and stable results over time, but it's a key differentiator in how we serve our agency partners. You know, for us to have these large, meaningful relationships, part of it is about how we do business. So we have a broader risk appetite, and that is actually a benefit to our agency partners. One of the biggest controls that we have in place on the underwriting side is a very tight hierarchy of underwriting authority. So each underwriter can work towards earning underwriting authority, but as they'll underwrite their business, and if it is outside of their authority, it'll get kicked up to the next level of authority. And our philosophy has always been to have very tight authorities. You know, as someone in underwriting management, we're going to look at files. We're either going to look at them on the front end or we're going to look at them on the back end. It wouldn't be a disciplined underwriting culture if we didn't look at files. And our thought process is that by looking at them on the front end, A, we prevent putting any undesirable risks on the book because you have a couple set of eyes. You have different experience levels, different knowledge bases, kind of throwing their two cents in on that underwriting decision. But that is also probably our greatest educational tool and our coaching tool. Let's talk about why you made the decision on this risk. Have you thought about that? Why don't you go back and reconsider that? So, you know, the individual account underwriting philosophy has a lot of benefits, but one of the ways we effectively control profitability then is by this underwriting authority process. We do also have an extensive and fairly comprehensive QA process on the back end, because while we look at more files on the front than we look at on the back, there are still some that an underwriting manager is not seeing. And we do quarterly reviews of those QA results with an annual summary. And anybody who fails to meet a target on one of the items will actually have to draft an action plan and implement that plan. And that's all controlled by the corporate underwriting team.
Could you explain that a little bit more? I'm not sure if I'm
following. We'll go back retrospectively and look at a file that an underwriter wrote, and you know, they decided to price it a certain way, they evaluated the loss history or the exposures in a certain way, and we'll critique it. We'll say, did you do this in accordance with Eastern standards, business practices, and our philosophy?
Whether you got business or not.
Yes. Yes. Another key control is our performance management process. If you were to pick up one of our underwriter performance reviews, you'll see that the whole first section of their review are their operational results. and those results directly align, excuse me, with what our overall company targets are. So we certainly look at the qualitative, you know, portion of their work as well, but the whole first part of it is, did you meet the targets? The second part is, did you do it the Eastern way? We have then at this corporate level, kind of looking out and supporting all of the regional offices, we have a team of very experienced corporate underwriters who are really focused on the referral process, the QA process, and also the educational side of what we do. Bob talked about our limited agency partners and the local business strategy that we have, but from an underwriting perspective, what that does is it gives that underwriter intimate knowledge of the territory and the businesses where they're writing. They know who the producers are. They know what the agency results are for the business opportunities that they're reviewing. Chances are they know a lot of the local businesses. They either patronize them or they've seen them before, they've underwritten them before. That local knowledge is something that we cannot minimize because it's really an important part of our ability to drive the results that we do. And those underwriters are working on small teams within each office. So when you look at our Mid-Atlantic region, it's a fairly large premium base. But we have smaller teams within each region, and those teams are comprised of claims, underwriting, and risk management, because we truly believe that there's a synergy from those three disciplines working together towards common goals than you would get out of individuals working in silos, which is how a lot of companies operate, where the company, the departments don't always communicate. Excuse me. When we talk about things like e-covery, you know, that process extends throughout the organization. The underwriter's making sure that the client is going to cooperate. When somebody doesn't bring someone back to work, the risk management person may be going out and looking at for modified duty job opportunities and working with the client to do that. So that collaboration between those teams, we think, is one of the key successes to how we deliver better outcomes. The underwriters within each of those teams, then, are assigned different premium sizes because there's a big difference between writing a $10,000 small business policy and writing a $500,000 policy. There's also a different agency partner that you're dealing with. You'll have partners within a shop that focus on large business, partners that focus on unity-sized business. So we align our underwriters to those premium segments as well, which gives them additional knowledge and expertise. And I'll say we have very sophisticated proprietary models for both loss forecasting and premium pricing. And those are models that have been built over our 17-year history. And, you know, part of our process there is we've streamlined a lot of processes where there's automatic data feeds going into our proprietary systems, which is great from both a quality control perspective to make sure that the data they're evaluating is accurate, but it's also been a huge advantage on operational efficiencies so that there's no rekeying of information and it makes it a lot faster for the underwriter to evaluate the risk. But those pricing models and the loss forecasting models, again, they support our ability to adequately price for the exposures that all of these different operations we're underwriting are bringing to us. And we really feel that the pricing models and the forecasting models are one of the key differentiators to us being able to produce consistent, predictable underwriting results for the company.
Okay.
Sorry, Chris.
So, like as Ned had mentioned in the beginning, like sort of as Affordable Care Act pushes further and further consolidation, so the medical groups will get larger and larger. I know currently you guys write businesses that are 1,000 employees and less. May see possibly a little bit of change in that as the medical groups get larger and larger.
And it's funny because most of our large accounts with large employee accounts do tend to be in the medical profession. They're not always large premium size accounts. They're sometimes large employee accounts. But, yeah, we do see that trend.
Okay.
Certainly. That was one of the reasons we upgraded our reinsurance.
Chris, you may have seen effective January 1st, we increased our reinsurance limits to $150 million. It used to be $40 million. We added a $110 million layer. And really, two thought processes there. One, the ability to service larger healthcare organizations, and two, the ability to deal with the uncertainty of the TRIA renewal coming up at the end of the year.
I talked about homegrowing some of our own underwriting talent. We have a very structured education program in place, formal orientation programs for folks coming in either with or without prior industry experience, and ongoing underwriter education programs. And some of those we actually do jointly with risk management as well. So we're always working on the professional development opportunities of our underwriters and doing training related to not just underwriting topics, but specific to different market segments or classes of business that we underwrite. We have folks who have a strong expertise in certain fields, so we do a lot to help share that expertise across the organization. Our data management and business intelligence tools and are, I think, another key differentiator for the company. We can quickly identify emerging trends within our book of business or quickly identify a pressure point or where we see an emerging opportunity. You know, a lot of it are proprietary tools that we've built, a huge business intelligence system that we can drill down to individual results and analyze within just a few clicks of a mouse. A pretty comprehensive monthly reporting package that we get as well. So, again, everything has been designed to take all that data over our 17-year history and help us make better decisions moving forward. And, you know, we think there's such a unique aspect to our business model that it makes sense to use our own historical data as we're moving forward.
Are you using your own internally developed systems to do all this underwriting, or are you using external vendors?
We are using our own systems. We did use a loss forecasting model from an actuarial firm in the past, but we decided to actually enhance that by using our own model, customizing it.
Given the size of your entity, I mean, do you think you have the right technology in place for your agency partners and for, you know, because oftentimes at insurance companies, you know, the technology investment can be lacking and it can create friction, you know, across the entire supply chain, if you will, from the customers to the agents to the insurance companies even internally.
I would say that we don't know of any pressure point in terms of our ability to deliver information to our agents because we're so active in communication with our agency partners and through the formal advisory council meetings. And quite frankly, when an opportunity has arose or they said, hey, we would like to see this, we go and we design it. We have an incredibly talented IT team in-house who does that for us.
Yeah, we do have a couple of partnerships. So, for example, when we implemented parallel pay, we use a third party to help us do that. Prior to doing that, we implemented something called EAPort, and that is our tool that we have deployed in the field for agencies.
Who's your third party that you use for parallel pay?
The name of the company behind it is Prestwick.
Prestwick.
Yeah.
Which was acquired by
Intuit
recently.
About 6 months. That same group of developers, owners, also were involved with a company called AgencyPort that we then branded EAPort, and we use that as our portal for agency partners to upload submissions directly to.
So AgencyPort is external or internal?
AgencyPort is the name of the company, external. We took it and branded it EAPort, you know, to add the Eastern piece to it. But it's a third party that's...
So it's like a white label type of solution, right?
So we do have some outside partners to help us, especially when it comes to pay-as-you-go and agency portal to upload submissions, and it's been a wonderful tool. We're actually working now on the download piece. So when we write a policy, we can actually push all the information back to an agency partner. For example, that's something that's pretty hot in the field, and we have working on solutions.
And so are you working on it internally, or do you have RFPs out to...
We're going to use an external partner for that.
And who are the external partners you're looking at for that?
Yeah. It's okay. But
you know what? There's a couple different ones that we're actually looking at the moment.
Okay.
But our team internally is going to manage that process, and that's probably the more important.
Sorry, Frank.
Since
just wondering who's in the marketplace providing those solutions.
So are the people who are trying to figure out who's providing those solutions.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Product management, another key differentiator for the company. In all of our operating territories, we have three pricing tiers available. So when we couple those three pricing tiers with scheduled rating, we have an incredibly broad amount of flexibility in pricing. And one of our key philosophies has always been to match that pricing tier to the quality of the individual risk. That has enabled us to really align our individual account underwriting strategy with rate structure so that we can hit our profitability targets. And Kevin had mentioned how diverse we are by class code, by territory. We're also incredibly diverse by size of premium, everything from a minimum premium policy to policies in excess of $1 million. And we're unique in that we have that very broad, diverse customer base. And the broad product spectrum that we have in place has enabled us to underwrite a broad and diverse book of business. We have a couple of products which have historically produced better than average returns for us, and you've heard some of those mentioned. Kevin mentioned the Nova, and Bob mentioned our Unity business. But those products which have historically produced the better returns are actually comprised more than 50% of our book. So we've been very successful in driving our customers to certain products that produce a better return for the company. So, any questions on any of the underwriting operations before I cover risk management philosophy?
One question. So with like 2% renewal rate and then loss cost still being above loss cost, what would you say your ideal retention would be? I think right now you mentioned it was like 83%. Like where would you?
You know, ideally I think it's in the mid 80s, and it varies a little bit by product. We do see higher retentions in ANOVA.
And Chris, I would add that's really been kind of the number over time. If you average a 17-year history, you have a couple of years where you're at 86, 87, a couple of years where you're slightly below. But if you were, you'd put a line down the middle of it, it'd be around that 85%.
Okay. From the start of the company, we have always made a significant investment in risk management. You know, Kevin joked that you can't measure what never happens, which drives them nuts, I think. But we have historically hired very talented, experienced people who don't just have strong technical knowledge, but they have an ability to build relationships and affect change at our policyholders, and that's a key factor that we're looking for as we're hiring and recruiting new talent. To kind of demonstrate our commitment to risk management, when I say it's a significant investment, typically when we go into a new region, risk management is one of the first hires we make. You know, no offense to Bob, but we hire risk management before we hire marketing typically. We want boots on the ground and eyes on those risks, especially as you're building out your agency plant and developing new agency relationships, kind of have a new agent, a new client. So we think risk management's a key factor in helping us to filter through and really find the best opportunities to underwrite. The differentiator for our risk management team beyond the talent and the experience level that they have is they go beyond consulting activities that are typical in our industry. Our industry typically calls the business loss control consulting, and most carriers have a more narrow focus than what we do. Our staff goes well beyond what a typical loss control consultant does, and they do it in a way that's different. And that risk management staff, they help underwriting better underwrite the risk. They give underwriting a lot of input on the exposures and how effective the controls are in that a client so that we can really determine what rate adequacy is and what price we can get for it. We also know that when we pre-screen an account, when we're out there with a risk management person face-to-face with the client, our hit ratio increases. We have a better opportunity that client's going to choose Eastern to do business, which really reflects very positively for the folks who are out there doing the consulting and the reputation that our risk management consultants have. And we use a lot of business intelligence tools and proprietary systems to help us manage the risk management work as well. And one of the things we've been able to do is look historically at what are our large losses and use that information to help drive our future activities. And a great example of that is we know from working with Suzanne that smoking is a key indicator on how bad a claim is going to be. So when we're evaluating a risk, we're actually asking about tobacco use among the workforce and trying to judge who's better than average, who's worse than average, because a wellness program can have a direct impact on ultimately what our claims costs are going to be. The objective for our risk management consultants, what they're charged with doing is to go out, partner with our agents, partner with our clients, and reduce the company's exposure to loss. And where we really want them focusing are on losses that we call fatal and life-changing injuries, the biggies. Not that we're going to ignore the smaller nuisance claims, but where do we see the greatest potential for severity, and how do we intervene to prevent those losses or mitigate the exposures so that we're at least significantly reducing the opportunity for that loss to occur? The risk management consultants are not measured on how many places they go and how many recommendations they write to clients, and I've worked in that environment. It's not a lot of fun. It's not a very rewarding job, and I also don't think it drives the best results. A lot of carriers do it because it's easy. You can count it. You can measure it. Very easy to track from that, but I don't think that gets us the best result at the end of the day. So our risk management consultants, if you look at their performance review, the first part of their review almost looks like the first part of the underwriter's review because it's the same objectives. We want them focused on driving our key operational targets, rate, retention, new business writings. They should be doing their job in such a way that it's driving our results to that ultimate goal. Another thing that we do a bit differently is we direct our service activity, who we visit and how often we visit them, based on the complexity of the risk, the nature of the exposures, and we do consider premium size, but that's almost a third element. We're looking more for where can we have those fatal and life-changing accidents and how do we intervene and consult with the clients to do that. So, and similar to our individual account underwriting philosophy, the risk management service strategy and the business plans that they're collaborating with and building with our clients are all tailored to the individual accounts. Now, of course, we're doing this on larger accounts, not the $20,000 account, but there's no cookie-cutter approach from Eastern. Besides the fact that we're going to talk about e-covery every time we're out there, everything else is tailored and customized to the individual client. So we really think our unique approach has a track record of delivering favorable loss results. It supports our ability to build very strong partnerships with our agents, with our clients. And at the end of the day, we know that those risk management consultants are adding a value, and that's a value perceived by the client, because it has helped us retain business even at a higher price. It's helped business from being shopped, because we'll have clients who say, I don't want to market my insurance this year because I like what I'm working on with Eastern. And we know that it helps drive rate through our book of business as well. It's a value that we're selling, not just an insurance product. We're working with that client to control their losses and prevent their employees from being injured. And we're doing it in such a way that they will stay with Eastern and even sometimes pay more premium to stay with us.
Are you capacity constrained?
Capacity constrained?
Are you limited in the amount of risk management and these other activities that you can do? And I ask the question because it sounds like you've got a nice thing going here. Why not do it more in more locations? It takes my earlier questions about growth and capacity and things like that. Do you just not have enough people? Do you cast your net a little wider in Tennessee and North Carolina where you've got such a little share? Shouldn't you be able to use the business systems and the and all that to pick more bids?
I think we're not constrained in terms of talent. You know, the team that we have probably has a little bit of capacity yet with the 28 consultants that we have on the team. I think I'll answer similar to how Bob did. We have the business and we have the staff to be able to meet the target that we have set for growth. So it's been a slow, disciplined growth, and have not had a challenge having the capacity for the staff to meet those growth targets.
So you can still be just as disciplined, but just do it on a wider scale and pick out the correct risk and grow a little faster. I mean, why not?
I think in terms of overlaying the Eastern way and doing it exactly correctly and profitably, the model only enables us to grow at a certain rate within the agency, the exclusive agency distribution network that Bob said. And I think it's really overlaying that Eastern model and doing that correctly and then moving on to the next thing is probably what's more constraining.
So you would say your restrictions are more internally focused.
Oh, there's no question about it. We could, as
whether
Mike said, we could.
The market goes up or down is not your focus. You are deliberately taking this.
Very purposefully and deliberately taking this to.
Do you think that your policy count should be able to grow at some consistent, predictable rate? And then pricing may get you a little more or less, mm-hmm. but your ability to grow your policy count should be. It's more of an internal directed engine.
Yeah, we could go out and appoint, instead of 205 agents, we could have, 410. We could go and we could open, five more regional offices, but we couldn't do it in a purposeful, deliberate way that is going to replicate the Eastern model, make our piece of paper, our workers' comp policy, something that's going to be long-term, consistent, and a better product than anyone else has.
Just a question. Obviously, as you guys partner with ProAssurance, your historical results in the healthcare space, would that be a similar combined ratio as the overall portfolio, or would it be any better or worse?
Very consistent. Very consistent, if not slightly better, but very consistent.
Have you ever run the results of your underwriting by feet? And what could you say? Because the CD is there, right? So, what is the differential between your combined ratio depends on the time?
Bob had quoted some market share statistics from AM Best. If you look at our 16 core states and you look at any state in which we have any kind of market penetration, which is quite limited, by the way, and to expand upon, Mark's comments, I think one of the favorable attributes of Eastern is in probably 15 of our 16 states, we have a ton of runway and a ton of market penetration. Nonetheless,
the question I'm asking is getting to this. Are you a better underwriter in the state, or is it just states you're in? I mean, both are good.
Yeah.
So I'm asking in the actual underwriting.
Yeah, and I apologize. I was going to get there after that little aside. But if we look at our top states in which we write business in and we look at ourselves compared to, say, the top 20 writers of workers' comp in each one of those states, we are generally the most profitable or second or third in any one of those states. Looking at adjusted or fully developed loss ratios on a calendar year basis. And what I always find interesting in Pennsylvania, just as a quick aside, where we've been there the longest, and we look at our 10-year average loss ratio. It's the best in the state. And the economy changed probably two or three times in the last 10 years, and the insurance market changed two or three times in the last 10 years. So I think that shows the sustainability of our results. We're number one in terms of 10-year average loss ratio in Pennsylvania.
Did you say you're number one or two or in the top tier in the other states as well, either or you've got small market share?
That's correct. Small market share aside, I would say like Indiana, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and even Maryland and Delaware, to a lesser extent, we're usually one of the top writers in terms of profitability. And that is in the AM Best market share report. So
public information.
Very public information.
Not to ask that on public stuff.
No, and the reason why I got off on a little bit of a tangent was to say not only are we the most profitable, but in 15 of the 16 states, we have huge runway on the premium side.
No, so the question really, and then you can answer the question. Obviously, there are some underwriters who are have better than average results simply because they happen to be in certain states that are good, right? And then their underwriters are actually better underwriters within the state. And that's
we think we're in the right states, and with the states we're in, we're one of the best.
All right, I guess we'll throw it open now for general question and answer. Kevin, will you open the phone lines and see if anybody has queued up? Again, I'll say we don't have any questions coming in online, so we'll see if there are any questions from the people who have dialed in, and then we'll wrap up with questions locally.
The star one to ask a question, star one. And we do not have any questions in queue.
All right. Any follow-up questions on any topic here in Lancaster? All right, well, we'll thank everybody for joining us today. Replays will be available. The slides were out on our website if you want to go back and download those. And we thank you for joining us today.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.